MacCast, Monday, May 28th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, as I sit down here to record this, we are just kicking off a new week, but we have a lot of stuff to go over. I'm a little bit delayed in getting this one out to you. I apologize for that, but we have a lot of great stuff to cover from the last week or so. So we are going to dive into a bunch of Mac news. I got some great hints and tips and questions from you as well. So sit back and get ready for all of that. But before we dive in, of course, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show's sponsors, and that's Smile. I want to talk to you today about PDF Pen and PDF Pen for iPad, both products that I use. I've been using PDF Pen for years. Absolutely love it. They now have PDF Pen for the iPad, so now I can have my PDF Pen on the go, which is just awesome, and it's easy to get stuff back and forth. It's gotten even easier because it now has Dropbox integration, so you can easily sync, if you have a Dropbox account, between your iPad and your desktop, move your PDF Pen documents, your PDFs, back and forth. And not that it was hard before, because it actually had a bunch of... I think PDF Pen has more integration for getting files in and out of PDF Pen than any other app. I'd actually like to see more apps do this, because it'd make all of our lives a lot easier. But they have iTunes integration. They have iDisk for as long as that's going to still be around. They have web dev support, Evernote, FTP, Google Docs, Dropbox, and, of course, iCloud integration. And they have one of the best iCloud integrations that I've seen so far as well, because until Apple actually integrates iCloud into the operating system, which isn't coming until Mountain Lion, you know, on the Mac, they have PDF Pen Cloud Access, a special app that you can get. You get it for free if you own PDF Pen for the Mac, or you can get it for 99 cents on the Mac App Store if you have a PDF Pen for the iPad, and it gives you a little window to all of your iCloud documents and allows you to get them in and out of PDF Pen seamlessly and easily. It's got a great user interface. And so, you know, once you have PDF Pen, you can view, you can edit, you can manipulate, you can annotate your PDFs, basically do anything that you want with them. I think it's the best PDF editor on the Mac. They also have this great object library. So if you do add elements and drawings and things like that to your PDFs, you can save those out for reuse later. And that library includes signatures, which is one of the number one things that I do with PDFs. We did a whole episode with David Sparks on going paperless. I am paperless, and when I'm dealing with PDFs, I like to be able to sign them electronically. So I just have my signature right there in there, and now I can do it on my iPad as well. Great for paperless workflows. Great for filling out what is called fake forms. You know, those PDF forms that you get that aren't really PDF forms. They're just a scanned-in document, and you have to, you know, type out a bunch of information on it. Most of us, there are a lot of people, print them out, and then you have to fill them out by hand, and then you got to go back to the computer, so maybe you scan them, and it's a mess. With PDF Pen, you can just do it all right directly on the document, and it's just an awesome app. You should grab it. You can get it on the Mac App Store, you can get it on the iOS App Store, or directly from the Smile website. They also have free trials available there, so if you just head over to smilesoftware.com, you can check it out and also check out all their other great apps. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So some of the stories we're going to get into in this episode are around Apple and their future plans, all the new products they have coming out, a lot of rumors and speculations about new iOS products, the new Mac products, new operating systems, and of course, Apple's been growing by leaps and bounds. We're going to talk about market share and how much that's expanding. And of course, to make all of that happen, Apple has to produce products. And Foxconn is the company that produces a lot of the Apple gear. And according to China Daily, they are planning on making a $210 million investment in a brand new plant in the Jiangsu province in China. The plant is supposed to begin construction in October and will eventually employ about 35,800 workers. And the reports are saying that the facility is going to be producing components for Apple. They don't cite what specific products and what's going to be manufactured there. It could be almost anything at this point, but big new facility plans for Foxconn in China. Apple also has big plans surrounding new Apple stores. Last week, they opened their third store in Paris, France. And this one is in the, and you French Canadians and French MacCast listeners out there, I'm going to apologize in advance, Les Quatre Temps shopping center. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly. And again, it's Apple's third store opening up in Paris. Apple also seems to be in the final stages of getting ready a new Apple store in Stockholm, Sweden. The location wasn't certain for a while, but now 99Mac is saying that it is going to be in the NK Mall in Stockholm. I guess there's also an NK Mall in Gothenburg. Actually, the report does say that Apple is potentially planning a Gothenburg location as well. And again, I apologize to my Swedish audience. I'm probably butchering your language as well. I just, you know, equal opportunity butchering of foreign languages. But they're looking at potential future stores in Gothenburg and Malmö. Or I guess I should say it's actually a second location, either in one or the other of those two places. So that would be two Swedish Apple stores expected. The first one, the one that's going to be in Stockholm, is expected to open up in the August or September timeframe. When Apple adds a store in Sweden, it'll represent the 13th country where Apple has a retail store presence. Apple currently has stores in the US, UK, Japan, Canada, Italy, Australia, China, Switzerland, Germany, France, Spain, Hong Kong, and the Netherlands. Over here in the U.S., Apple supposedly has just begun construction on a big new Apple store that's going to be on campus at the University of Stanford. It's supposedly going to be an all-glass structure. They had some kind of design comps or design images up online, and it looks truly beautiful. It's just like this giant glass enclosure with a roof. How they pull that kind of stuff off, I have no idea. It just doesn't even seem to be any vertical steel support structure that you can see, at least in the illustration. I'm sure it's in there, but especially considering the kinds of earthquakes we have here in California. But just amazing, truly amazing. So Apple is definitely expanding its retail store presence. They've been doing that aggressively over the last several years, and it looks like that they are continuing to do so. As you know, Apple and Samsung continue to have this strange relationship. Apple is one of Samsung's biggest customers, yet they are also embroiled in these ongoing lawsuits. And it was supposed to kind of get a little bit of help, or at least that was the plans of the U.S. courts, at least a court in Northern California, when they sort of forced or told the CEOs to get together in a room and try and work out settlement talks. Well, does it surprise anyone if I tell you that Samsung and Apple have sort of agreed to disagree when it comes to their patent disputes? They went into talks last week and it did not yield any results. Apple CEO Tim Cook and Samsung CEO Chao Ji-sung met for 2 days in Northern California, but did not come to any sort of agreement. The parties both say they wanted to avoid court, but it looks like that's exactly where they're going to be heading sometime in July. Apple is arguing that Samsung has been slavishly copying their designs, and Samsung, for their part, is arguing that Apple is infringing on several of their wireless patents. Apple's defense on the wireless patent side is that they use chipsets from Qualcomm, and Qualcomm has agreements in place with Samsung already. So by FRAND standards, they should be covered for those patents. As far as how the design copying goes, of course, Samsung completely denies copying any of Apple's designs. When you look at their phones and devices, though, I think it's a little bit hard to argue that they aren't at least influenced by some of the things that Apple has done. And because of the close partnership, it does seem a little bit suspect. But either way, it looks like the courts are going to have to decide the outcome of this one, and we'll see what happens around July. Maybe both companies will come to their senses and reach an agreement before then. It, usually what happens is, you know, at some point there's some sort of cross-licensing deal that takes place. But so far, they continue to seem to be butting heads. Apple released a very odd GSM update for the iPhone 4 last week. iPhone 4 GSM update 5.1.1. And if that sounds familiar, it's because Apple did release 5.5.1 earlier and then suddenly put out a revised build toward the end of last week. The build is numbered 9B208, And it is only for GSM iPhone 4 owners who had not yet updated to 5.1.1. So if you had already applied the 5.1.1 update, you actually won't see this show up in your software updates. You won't have any indication that there is a different build number. It will just be there if you ever go back and restore your phone. So there were no release notes, no indication of what might be fixed. What was interesting was the timing did seem to coincide with the release of the Absinthe 2.0 untethered jailbreak. So there was a lot of theory and speculation that it might have just been put out to combat that for anybody who hadn't already updated to 5.1.1. Almost immediately, the Absinthe team, though, released their own update to address the jailbreak compatibility with Apple's new build. So, you know what? Cat meet mouse, mouse, cat. I don't think Apple's going to be able to do anything to stop the jailbreaking. It really surprises me that they would even try. So if that's all this update was for, Apple was highly unsuccessful in making that happen. As far as getting the new build, if you really, really want it, you can force getting it by doing a full restore in iTunes. So just back up your iOS device, run the restore, and you will get the newer version of the build if you have a GSM iPhone 4. Now, an interesting report came out this week from an analytics firm, and I was a little bit confused when I first started reading the headlines, or I misinterpreted the headlines when I first started diving into these articles, because they said that the new iPad had just surpassed the iPad to become the most popular of the iPads. And when I read that, I naturally assumed that it had surpassed the popularity of the iPad 2, but no, what they were actually saying was that it was now more popular or in use more frequently than the original iPad. The data came from software analytics firm Loyalytics, and they're reporting that the new iPad is being used by U.S. consumers just a tad bit more now than the original iPad 1. Their data is based on usage of apps that use their software for gathering analytics. The iPad 2, however, still has them both handily beat as the most popular Apple tablet in the United States. Right after the new iPad launched, I guess the third generation iPad was in use by 14% of U.S. consumers. That was versus about 24% who were still using the original iPad 1. Now the research firm says that the latest numbers show that the iPad third generation, the new iPad, is in use by 20% of U.S. consumers, and they claim that's slightly above the original iPad. For comparison, though, the iPad 2 is about 60% usage in the U.S., and so it's handily trouncing both of them. Overall, though, in the tablet space, the iPad does continue to dominate. I don't think many of us find that too surprising. The latest NPD numbers came out last week, and they showed that iPads account for about 62.8% of the tablet market in the March quarter. And when you combine the iPad with netbooks and notebooks, what NPD now terms mobile PCs, Apple actually dominates the entire mobile PC space with a 22.5% share of the market. And surprisingly, that's almost double what HP's market share is. They're the second closest competitor with 11.6% market share. Now, if you take iPads out of the mix and just count laptops, it turns out that Apple doesn't even make the top five in terms of notebook market share. And I guess notebooks would also include netbooks as well. And, you know, the MacBook Air is pretty popular, so it was surprising to me that Apple didn't show up in the top five. But once you lump in iPads, and NPD, I guess, has been doing this for a while, where they count mobile PCs as the term. And I think that's right, because there's a lot of people who are now using an iPad or a tablet as their primary PC device. So we are transitioning, I think, into that post-PC era, and the numbers should reflect that. So we'll kind of continue, I think, on the MacCast to take a look at both sets of numbers, and I'll try and deliver both of them to you, at least for the near future, because it does make sense to kind of look at both of them. Apple and Android, though, are still both tops in smartphones. I don't think, again, that surprises anyone either. IDC came out with their latest figures last week, and they showed for the first quarter of 2012 that there were about 152 million smartphones shipped. Android was shipped on about 59% of those devices, while iOS garnered a 23% share. Of the Android sets, Samsung has far and away the majority lead for Android devices. 45.4% to be exact of the smartphones out there are sporting a Samsung label. The Android smartphones out there, of course, 23% are sporting an iOS label. And it's really, that's another one of those comparisons I think that's hard to talk about when you're looking at these numbers, because I sometimes feel it's not really fair to compare iOS devices versus Android devices, because there are so many Android handsets out there and so many devices running Android. You really almost want to look at devices from specific manufacturers. So HTC phones versus iPhones, or Samsung phones versus iPhones. But those were the numbers that were showing up this week. And needless to say, Apple and Android for sure are the dominant operating systems, well above Nokia and RIM at this point. So do you love or hate Siri? She seems to be getting a lot of attention recently, good and bad. There's been a lot of debate. I think a lot of it sparked by Apple launching this whole series of Siri and celebrity-based ad campaigns. They've had ads featuring Samuel L. Jackson and Zooey Deschanel recently, and then just this past week, they launched two new ones that feature John Malkovich. They're great ads. If you haven't caught them, they're up on Apple's website at apple.com, or they're running in pretty heavy rotation on television, at least here in the States. I'm not sure how they're doing it internationally. Generally, they have their own kind of international ads with international celebrities, so these may be U.S. only. But all the attention might not be as welcome as Apple was hoping, because there's some people out there that are starting to say that Apple is overstating some of the claims of Siri's accuracy. This past week, Paul Kafasis from Rogue Amoeba put a post on his website about his unsuccessful attempts to kind of replicate some of the phrases that were said in the Samuel L. Jackson commercial. I'll have a link to his blog post in the show notes at maccast.com. He was trying to specifically work with the phrase where I think Samuel L. Jackson says, "Siri, remind me to put the gazpacho on ice in an hour." And I have to say, I tried the same thing, and I had exactly the same results as Paul. Siri happily translated it into phrases like, put the spots on ice hour. Just odd results came out of it, and I could not get her to recognize the word gazpacho to save my life. And I think that's where some of the frustration comes in. And I don't think Paul was trying to bash Apple in his piece. I think he was just trying to point out that the commercials make it seem like it's so wonderful and easy. And very often, if you've used Siri, you'll have those moments. And Paul even puts this in his post, and I think it's great, where you're just, everything you say to Siri, she'll come back with a response and it's not the right one. And you have to say no or cancel or no, no, no. And that's never shown in the commercials. Right. And so I think part of this problem is actually on Apple. But overall, I have to say that I am really happy with Siri. Fortune, however, this week, you know, this is where this comes from. It starts snowballing as Fortune came out with a piece, and they claim that there were sources inside Apple that were reportedly embarrassed by Siri, and even said that Steve Jobs would have lost his mind over Siri. And to that, I say, really? I mean, that's, to me, getting a little bit overblown. Some have even taken it so far, of course, as to filing class action lawsuits saying that they were misled and the phone doesn't do what Apple claims it would do. And, you know, it's the typical thing. Apple's response, which I think is appropriate, is, hey, if you didn't like the phone, you can return it. We have a 14-day return policy and we'll give you your money back. But personally, beyond a few little instances or a few specific words and phrases that I've had trouble with Siri, and beyond this one strange Samuel L. Jackson quote in this one commercial, I have to say Siri performs pretty well for me most of the time. And many of the phrases in the other commercials work out just great. Some people are saying that Apple with the John Malkovich commercials made it more accurate because they had been getting some of the complaints. I don't know if that's really true or not. I don't know if I really buy that, or if maybe that this kind of thing is the problem.
You got Siri, huh? Voice recognition on that thing is terrible. Look. Siri, can you recommend a West one?
I'm sorry, Bowie. I don't understand recommend a West a want.
Listen to me, not West want, West want.
I don't know what you mean by not West a want, West a want.
See? Total crap. You suck, Siri.
So, I apologize for the laugh track on that. That's, of course, from Big Bang Theory. And I say that, I play that because that's, to me, how crazy this whole argument over Siri and the accuracy and stuff is. It's just, it's getting kind of blown out of proportion. So hopefully that puts it in a little lighter perspective. But bringing it back and making it a little more serious, you know, I think that Siri is not perfect, but she and might not respond to some of the exact phrases that are in the commercials, but it's pretty darn good. And I think Apple's biggest mistake is that they might just be promoting it too heavily, especially for a technology that they themselves are calling beta. They're putting it prominently in some major commercials with major celebrities, and that makes people think that it's a fully baked feature. And to me, that is where they made a big misstep. They shouldn't be doing that with a beta technology. If they felt it was that ready for prime time, then they probably shouldn't have called it beta. But I think most of us would agree that it has its little quirks and some kinks to get worked through and worked out. And I can absolutely understand their enthusiasm because I think it's some of the best speech technology, voice recognition technology, and natural language parsing technology on the planet, and they are right to be proud of it. And it's looking like they are proud of it enough that they may be planning on bringing it to the macOS 10 desktop, so it'll make that transition from iOS to macOS 10. Many people have believed since the very beginning that this would be great technology on the desktop. Well, this week in some of the beta builds of macOS 10, 10.8 Mountain Lion, in the Safari portion, it looks like there's references to Siri, at least the voice dictation part. According to reports, Safari in the latest preview builds of Mountain Lion contains a resource file mentioning using a command-command hotkey to start dictation. It's interesting that you may need to press both command keys simultaneously to turn on dictation. And when I read this report, I thought it was a little bit odd, but I guess you got to start somewhere. I tried it. It feels a little bit awkward. I have to imagine that the feature, once it's implemented, Apple will eventually put out a new version of the keyboard that would have its own dedicated function key for activating Siri and dictation features. Basically, the analog equivalent of what you have on the iOS virtual keyboard, the little Siri speaker key. On iOS, it's down there kind of at the bottom, so I guess that's maybe why they chose to use the command keys for this first implementation. I think ultimately it may end up as one of the specialized function keys. Maybe it could replace something like the dashboard key, since that's now kind of built into Mission Control. I don't know. It might be nice it was down lower on the keyboard as well, but where you would squeeze it in, I have no idea. Point is that Siri is likely going to make its way to the desktop. I think there's no doubt about that at some point. And as far as the accuracy and quality, once again, give it a break. I think it can only get better. And it was a pretty darn good start to begin with. There continues to be more and more evidence that the WWDC announcements are going to be plentiful and large and very exciting, especially on the Mac hardware side. This week, Ben Reitzis of Barclays Capital over at the Wall Street Journal was echoing a number of the rumors that we've been already talking about, that we'll see new Macs around WWDC in just a couple weeks, that they would feature new Ivy Bridge quad-core processors and have Retina high DPI displays. It's also being rumored and possible that we might see an early release of Mountain Lion to coincide with Macs. And I guess I say early release tentatively because Apple did say Mountain Lion would come out this summer. Generally, in the past, when Apple gives a wide time frame like that, it's usually toward the end of that time frame, not the beginning. So it would be a little bit surprising to get Mountain Lion early, but they have been pushing out a lot of developer builds, and as far as I've been reading, I don't think there's a lot of critical issues. In addition to the dictation feature that could possibly make its way into Mountain Lion, some of the other new features we're hearing about, is there some indication that Safari's reading list feature might get expanded to include an offline mode in Mountain Lion? So that has been enabled in recent developer builds, and the feature, I guess, is there to make it more like some of the other services like Instapaper and Pocket or Read It Later that's out there now. I think Apple has experienced some kind of slow uptake with the reading list, and they're thinking that maybe that'll help them out. As far as that having any impact, I think that Apple can't compete with a lot of these services because, frankly, their service is limited to just Safari, and people use other browsers, they use other devices, and you can't get kind of a dedicated app to access your reading list like you can on tablets. So I love the Instapaper app or the Pocket app on my iOS device for getting at those articles, and I can send those articles to those services from all kinds of different software, not just Safari on my Mac desktop. So Reader on my desktop is a great example. I get all of my RSS feeds in there, and I like to send it over. And this is the same problem I think Apple has classically had when they try to roll these kinds of features into the operating system. And I'm thinking of like RSS in Mail or RSS in Safari. I know very few people that use those features because they're sort of cumbersome, or even like podcasts in the music app on iOS devices. They just don't work all that well. And I think it's because, in my opinion, they're afterthought features for Apple. It's something they added kind of after the fact, after some third party came out with a really great solution that works really well. And, you know, just like Apple's competitors, anytime Apple tries to copy a feature, they rarely seem to do it very well. And even when they go out and buy technologies from a developer, they very rarely seem to integrate it well into the operating system. It seems like these are technologies that have to be born out of innovation. And that's what Apple's really great at. That's what a lot of third-party developers are really great at. But sort of copying or trying to borrow, quote-unquote, borrow features, they just always feel like they're kind of shoehorned into the operating system, and they never work out very well for me. But maybe reading list will be an exception. I don't know. I'd be curious to know if any of you have really used it. I've tried playing around with it a little bit. I use it here and there, but it hasn't become one of those core sort of features that I use like Instapaper or Pocket. So just my two cents on that one. It's also been reported that the App Store in Mountain Lion will get the automatic app download feature. This would allow Macs that are registered with the same Apple Store ID to automatically download and install applications purchased from another Mac onto a Mac that's registered with the same account. So this is very much in the same way that you can set up your iOS devices, where if I download an app on my iPad, it will also, if it's a universal app, automatically download and install on my iPhone if I'd like it to do that. So I think that's a natural progression of the Mac App Store, and it doesn't surprise me that that is another new feature that's being rumored for Mountain Lion. As far as what's going to happen at WWDC in terms of hardware, the belief right now is that it's going to at least be a MacBook Air, new MacBook Air using the Ivy Bridge technology. Also, very likely a new 15-inch MacBook Pro. It's interesting that that's the only model that's being rumored. Whether Apple would also bring out a new 13-inch along with that and possibly a 17-inch, you're not really hearing too much about that. It seems like that one size is what's really been fixated on. I could see them moving to a single size in the MacBook Pro line. It's not inconceivable. I don't think they'll do it right away with this first generation, but with the MacBook Air at the 11 and 13-inch size, and then you get the 15-inch MacBook Pro, I think the 17-inch is going to hang on for a little while longer, but they might not announce that right out of the gate. That may come along a little bit later. Just my own personal theory. I haven't really read any rumors about that, but it seems to make sense when you start thinking about it. And then the other new Macs that are sort of rumored pretty heavily to be announced pretty soon are the iMacs. I think they would very likely be in the cards. There have also been some rumblings of us finally getting a Mac Pro update. I think many people want that to happen. I believe there's a petition out there right now online, if you'd like to go sign it, for trying to convince Apple that they need to put out another Mac Pro, or at least give professionals some sort of update on when they might see or expect a MacBook Pro. Not historically something Apple has done, but at this point, it's gotten so long in the tooth, I can understand why pros are clamoring for that kind of information. But there are some new processors out there that would make sense. We talked about those in the past on the MacCast for a new MacBook Pro, and I think Apple will update it. Probably not a lot of major external changes, mostly internal in terms of new graphics cards, obviously Thunderbolt ports and new processors in there, but I think the form factor is going to stay relatively the same. We haven't heard anything at all about a new Mac Mini, but that's not really surprising. Typically, the Mac Mini seems to be the last model to get any kind of revision or update, and it's usually bumped quietly either when the new models start arriving or a few months later. So that, I think that would be the general modus operandi that Apple would go through again as it's bringing out new hardware. But any way you look at it, I think the next couple weeks are going to be a very exciting time in Apple and Mac news, and I look forward to bringing it to you. Although, right before WWDC, I do have my vacation. So, first week of June, I will be out of town. I'm going to try and get a MacCast out for you. We'll see if that happens or not. If you don't hear from me that week, that's what I'm doing. I'm off on vacation. Otherwise, hopefully, I'll get a little episode in for you, maybe before I leave. Of course, over the past week or so, Facebook has been in the news for their IPO. It was a little bit rocky for them, I think. It was exciting and then sort of went up and dropped, and there was a lot of hype, and now there's a lot of post-analysis about what Facebook is going to be doing and how are they going to be profitable, or I guess they are profitable, but how are they going to continue to make money and continue to grow now that they are a public company? Well, this week we heard a little Apple rumblings, or at least a little smartphone rumblings from the New York Times. They say Facebook has been hiring some ex-Apple engineers to help them produce a smartphone that they plan to put out sometime next year. According to the All Things D blog, Facebook has an ongoing project that started in 2011, codenamed Buffy, and it's a hardware project supposedly in development in conjunction with HTC, and they will build a Facebook-centric smartphone running the Android operating system. Facebook also supposedly had a smartphone in the works way back in 2010, but that project was scrapped and sort of replaced by this Buffy project. Now seems that they've hired, according to reports, six former Apple engineers who worked on the iPhone and one engineer who's worked on the iPad. The rumor is that after many of the failed attempts, they felt that it was just due to the lack of in-house hardware engineering talent and that they would have to hire from outside to hopefully prop things up and get the project back on track. When asked about the project, Facebook didn't confirm or deny that they were working on a smartphone, but I would say hiring former Apple hardware engineers and the rumors, all the rumors of the recent hardware projects are probably pretty good indications that they likely are up to something in that space. Does it make sense for a web software company like Facebook to get into smartphone hardware? I don't know. You know, who would have said that Apple would have done well getting into smartphone hardware? Apple has a little more background in the hardware side of things, but you also have Google, who put out a fairly successful smartphone product. So if Google can do it, who's to say that Facebook couldn't do it? And especially if they're hiring some very talented people from one of the companies that makes the best smartphones on the planet. I think that's probably a pretty smart move. And those guys, those engineers, probably know a thing or two about building great smartphones. So we'll have to see what Facebook does. And it sounds like if and when they do something, it may be toward the end of this year. Now, one bit of talent from Apple that Facebook likely isn't going to have is Jonathan Ive. And so design, hey, they're on their own on that front. Well, there was some speculation that Ive might be looking for new work, and that happened earlier last week, although those rumors have kind of been put to rest. Actually, Sir Jonathan Ive, now twice, was knighted for a second time last week, and he gave an interview to the BBC that kind of squashed rumors that he was considering leaving Apple. In the interview, Ive claimed that he wanted to stay with the same team that he'd been working with for the past 15 years. Since really about 2011, there have been sort of these rumors going on that Ive wanted to potentially leave Apple, or at least wanted to return to England so that his kids could go to school there. Actually, not long after he was knighted, he gave a speech, and during that speech, he credited the UK school system and his British heritage as being major things that kind of helped shape his design education. So he obviously puts a lot of value in a British education, so it would make sense that, you know, he would want his own kids to have a similar type experience. Ive also gave an interview to the London Telegraph where he was asked about products and specifically which products he hoped to be remembered for, and his response was a little bit surprising, and again gives indication that he's planning on staying at Apple and that he's looking forward to what's coming forth from Apple. He said, you know, what we're working on now feels like the most important and best work we've done. And so it would be what I'm working on right now, which, of course, I can't tell you about. So he's very excited about the product that's coming out. A lot of people are speculating and thinking that that is the Apple TV. That was something that in the Walter Isaacson book, Jobs is quoted as saying he's cracked the sort of TV issues, and many people and many rumors are pointing to Apple doing something great in that space. So maybe that's what Ive is excited about, or maybe it's something completely different. But whatever it is, he's obviously excited about it. And if Ive is excited about it, you could imagine that we are probably going to be over the moon excited about it. The guy just has such a great talent and makes such great products. And, you know, what do they say? Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. So I think if you look at tablets and smartphones that are out on the market right now, and also many computers and just other areas of design, his influence is extended and broad reaching, and just an amazing guy. And it's good to know that it sounds like he's not having any thoughts or plans or desires to leave Apple anytime soon. Apple's plans for their North Carolina data center made one more step in getting greener. The North Carolina Utilities Commission has approved Apple's plan to build a 4.8 megawatt fuel cell facility near their data center in Maiden, North Carolina. The fuel cells are actually one of two types of green energy Apple is planning on employing at the facility, and will at least help provide a portion of the energy needed to run the massive data center. Depending upon who you're talking to, Apple says it's going to fuel the whole data center on renewable energy. Earlier, Apple received approval to move forward on construction of a 20 megawatt photovoltaic solar facility that will provide the other green source of power. The solar farm is actually going to be built on about 200 acres of land that is near the facility. Apple already uses some of the fuel cells that they plan to use in that complex at their offices in Cupertino. The fuel cells are called Bloom Boxes. They're made by a company called Bloom Energy that is in Sunnyvale, California. The cells themselves use natural gas. Apple says they're going to get that from a local pipeline, and they'll use that to generate electricity. The fuel cells will then produce as a byproduct both CO2 and water as their only output. So definitely a green source of energy. Apple also will reportedly get some of the natural gas to power the cells from a separate biogas supplier, making the system even greener. They've had some sort of complaints, especially from Greenpeace, that they'll have to still rely on some coal original sources for some of the raw materials going into even their renewable energy sources. So they're taking some flack for that. Greenpeace and others have been arguing that Apple is grossly underestimating the data needs for their data center. They claim that Apple will need about 100 megawatts to power the facility. Apple's claiming that they only need 20 megawatts, which would, if you were paying attention, would show that the 20 megawatt photovoltaic, the solar facility, would actually provide all of their energy needs. And then they have the almost 5 megawatt fuel cell facility on top of that. So I think that's where Apple's saying, hey, we've got fully renewable energy going online at this place. They're saying that Greenpeace has based their estimates purely on how much money Apple has spent on the facility. They spent a rumored $1 billion, and also on the size of the data center compared to other comparable data centers. Apple and others claim that the figures don't account for the fact that major portions of that funding, the $1 billion, was used to build out the solar farm and the fuel cell facilities. So not all of it went into the main data center. They also say it doesn't factor in a lot of the non-data and non-computer areas of the facility, things like hallways and walkways and restrooms and lobbies. A lot of that square footage isn't dedicated to purely, you know, doing the data serving portions, which take the large portions of energy, you know, and cooling and things like that. So there's a back and forth on all of that. Either way, I think Apple should be commended for building this type of facility. Once it comes online, the fuel cell facility is going to be the largest private fuel cell facility in the nation. And Apple actually plans to sell some of the excess that they might generate back to Duke Energy, which is the local energy supplier in that area. So I think that anytime a company puts forth some money to invest in some of these technologies and help fund further development of these technologies, it's a good thing, because that's how we get these things moving forward. So even if it's not 100% green, it's moving us in the right direction. And I think Apple does deserve to take a little bit of credit for that. And then finally in the news for this week, it's looking like the next generation iPhone might get a slightly larger screen. And this is one rumor that I've been sort of fighting for the longest time. But now with this latest batch of information that's coming out, I'm starting to come around and see that, yeah, maybe it might have a little bit larger screen. And the reason I'm starting to think about it a little bit more is we're getting reports from multiple sources that claim the next generation iPhone is going to have between a 3.95 to 4-inch screen. Images have surfaced online that claim to be an iPod Touch front panel, and typically the form factor of the iPod Touch follows the iPhone. And in looking at this panel, it's slightly taller, but not really wider than the current screen. Most of the reports seem to be consistent in saying that the larger display will be taller and not much wider, if at all wider. It might actually maintain the same width. And it's also believed that the display will fit into a new design that pretty much retains the current proportions in terms of height and width dimensions of the current generation iPhone, the iPhone 4S. And it's going to be achieved by basically reducing the areas around the home button and the speaker button, or the speaker hole and FaceTime camera, to make room for the taller display, and then probably a slightly less bezel, if that's even possible, along the edges if they have to widen it a little bit. But they are going to keep the Retina resolution. The belief is that it would move from what is, I think, like a 3:2 aspect ratio now. It would move to more toward a true 16:9 aspect ratio. Pixel dimensions that are being reported are 640 by 1136 pixels per inch. That would actually give Apple room for an entire fifth row of icons on the home screen, and would better support HD movies and TV content, something that Apple has been pushing forward on iTunes. So it makes sense from that standpoint. A common argument against Apple changing the resolution of the next generation iPhone is that developers would have another screen resolution, another size that they'd kind of have to code to. John Gruber over at Daring Fireball wrote an interesting piece, and he pointed out something interesting that to me made a lot of sense. And that was that if you make the screen just taller, wider in the landscape portion, most iOS apps are expected to a certain degree to be able to scale in that single direction. And the example he pointed to was the double height little menu bar that, or status bar that comes up while you're on a phone call and when you go to another app. So if you're on a phone call and you go to the calendar app, you know, you have that sort of bar that shows up along the top, and everything just kind of squishes down. The UI takes care of that, sort of handles it for you, like the space between the icons just tightens up. And so I could imagine existing apps sort of functioning and working that way, especially if they use the built-in UI controls. And a lot of developers, they use the native UI control elements, so they should, in theory, scale properly already. Things like lists. So if you have a list view in your application, you could just simply squish up the pixels, reduce the padding between the lines and the text a little bit, and gain back that little bit of space. And that really wouldn't require an app developer to recode anything. For games and things like that, you might have to do a little bit of stretching and scaling, but even if you did it somewhat disproportionately, it's not going to be hardly noticeable. And then, you know, over generations, you could optimize for the newer, slightly taller size. So I think, and a couple developers were asked about this, it's not going to be a huge issue if Apple just makes the screen a little bit taller. So that's kind of why I'm coming around to this idea that it could be simply that. And Bloomberg was one of the other organizations confirming that there is a larger iPhone screen on the way. They report that the project was actually one of the last design projects that Steve was working on before he passed. So if that's truly the case, I have a feeling Apple's going to want to really push that forward and get that into production, into the pipeline, and out into the market as sort of a legacy for Steve, if that really is the case. And it just makes sense, especially with a lot of the other phones and devices moving to larger screen sizes. My big argument against it always was, I don't want a bigger phone. I like how pocketable the current form factor is. And so if they can squeeze a larger screen into the same form factor, which sounds like what they're trying to do, then I think absolutely Apple would likely move forward with it, especially if there's not a huge impact on developers, because they definitely want to keep their developers happy and stuff like that. And it sounds like if they move forward with this plan, that will all work out. So Maybe a new iPhone. iPhone, in terms of time frame, still being rumored that it'll be on that yearly cycle, coming out sometime in the fall, probably in the October time frame, in case you're wondering about that. So with that, that's going to do it for the news. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that's Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, I've talked to you about Notebook on several occasions. It's great for taking notes. It's great for doing research, but it goes way beyond that. You can go way beyond just taking notes with the application. They've got really great built-in drawing and annotation tools, so you could do flowcharts, you can do diagrams, you can just do hand freeform drawings and take handwritten notes or draw little sketches and things like that right into your notebook. On top of that, you can add in post-it notes and comments. You can drop in PDF files, things that you can put information on top of, annotate, make call-outs to, do all those sorts of things, and keep it kind of all together and organized into individual notebooks, maybe surrounding projects and things like that. That's in a lot of ways how I use it. I have different projects, different notebooks for different things, and it just keeps everything together. So it almost becomes like a project organizer, a note taker. You can build to-do lists. You can just do a million things with it. It has voice annotation. So if you want to just make some little voice notes, I'm much better with voice stuff than writing stuff down, which is why I do a podcast and not a blog. So I find features like that incredibly useful and incredibly powerful. And it's all built right into Notebook. They also have an iOS version of the application. And so you can move your documents seamlessly back and forth. Has all of the great features on the iOS version as it does on the desktop, and they're constantly improving, they're constantly updating and reiterating and making the product better and better. But you don't have to take my word for it. You can check it out. They have a free 30-day trial on their website. You can also get more information and details there. Check out all of the features, and you really should. Go to circusponies.com, check it out, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So I have a cool little bit of follow-up to something I covered on a recent episode of the MacCast. I had talked about duplicates. Somebody had asked me about removing duplicates. I think it was in Mac OS X, but I dove in a little bit deeper, and we talked about removing duplicates in iPhoto and iTunes and just in the Mac and some third-party software and some built-in ways to do that. And on that episode, I covered how to identify duplicates out of the box with the built-in features that are in iTunes. And I received an email, a follow-up from one of you. Mike actually pointed out that I had forgotten about one of the features. And I knew about this, and I had meant to put it in my show notes, and I simply left it off, which is why I love this community. Because Mike emails me and says, hey, you know, you forgot to mention that there is a way to show exact duplicates in iTunes. So the feature that I covered is when you go into iTunes, you select your music library, you can go into the file menu, and there is a display duplicates option. And when you do that, it'll go through and it'll try and find duplicate songs in your music library. But if you have tracks in there that are the same song and artist, but maybe a different album, so you might have, say, for example, the main album and the track from that main album, and then also that same artist is your favorite artist, so you have a greatest hits album, and there's the same track on that, and they'll show up as duplicates when you use just the standard find duplicates feature. And obviously, in that case, those are not duplicates. You may also have a track that was the same track, but a different artist. Maybe it was a cover or something like that. So those things, you know, show up as duplicates, and you kind of get these false duplicates. Well, luckily, iTunes has this other find duplicates option, which is display exact duplicates. So if you hold down the option key when you go to the file menu, you'll notice the display duplicates option changes to display exact duplicates. And if you pick that, then it's only going to find duplicates where all or at least most of the metadata exactly matches. So things all the way down to like the length of the track, and as long as it's the same artist, same album, same length of track, I don't know what other kinds of mojo it uses, but it'll definitely reduce your list, and you can find just the things that are purely exact duplicates, and that might help you out. And you can toggle back and forth between the two views, just go back in, you know, reset it, and then you can display the other type of duplicates. So thanks, Mike, for pointing that out, and I'm sorry and apologize that I forgot to mention that on the last episode. Now, as we get here close to June, and I've brought this up a couple times, but it keeps coming up. A lot of you are emailing me about the impending transition, the move from MobileMe to iCloud. And unfortunately, I think there's still a lot of confusion, a lot of frustration, a lot of concerns about what's going to happen on June 30th when Apple turns off MobileMe and forces us finally all over to iCloud. So a lot of people are making the transition right now. And one of those questions that keeps coming up has to do with specifically iWeb, and more specifically with the MobileMe iWeb hosting. And I did an in-depth episode on this for MacCast members, episode 93. It was called The Death of iWeb. If you're not a MacCast member and you'd like to hear that episode, you can sign up at member.maccast.com. And right now I'm going to offer a discount. If you want to get a 6-month or a yearly subscription, I have a coupon code for 20% off a 6-month or a yearly MacCast membership subscription. Just use the coupon MacCast20, MacCast20 at checkout, and that'll give you 20% off. If you want to get a month-to-month subscription, those are also available, but I don't have a discount on that. It's just on the 6-month or yearly subscription. So you can sign up, you can give that a listen. But I thought I'd still give a quick summary of some of the options that I went through in that episode. First and foremost, I think that there is this kind of big misconception that iWeb itself is somehow going to blow up and cease to work on June 30th, and that if you haven't moved your website, suddenly, poof, it's going to go away and everything's going to be broken. You're going to lose everything out of iWeb and it's going to be all gone. That really isn't the case. Well, not entirely. I mean, if you have your site hosted only on MobileMe and you haven't moved it, or if you're using a custom domain and you haven't transitioned that or moved it, then yes, your actual hosting of your website's going to go away. But in terms of the actual content, all the stuff that you've put into iWeb, it's still going to be in there. You'll still be able to launch the iWeb application. You'll still be able to manage it. You'll still be able to edit. You'll still be able to work on your website. The major difference is you're going to have to find a new place to host it. You're going to have to get a new service, and you're going to have to switch from the iWeb publishing, which is really easy and built in, and that was what was so great about it. You're going to have to switch from that over to the slightly more complicated but really not insurmountable FTP publishing. You can really figure this out if you go out and get a host, you know, a different hosting company and publish your website someplace else. You can use FTP and it works pretty well. There are some specific features that will not function or don't work quite the same when you're publishing through FTP versus iWeb, and specifically things like RSS feeds or the subscribe buttons. Those will not work unless you've actually entered your site URL into the settings if you're publishing through FTP. So you'll want to make sure that you go in and you enter your website's address into the website URL field in the website publishing settings window in iWeb. And if you do that, your RSS feeds and subscribe buttons should continue to work just fine. Another feature that's not going to work just straight out of the box is going to be password-protected sites. That was an iWeb feature, but I will tell you that many website hosting companies will allow you to add a protected folder after you publish your iWeb site through FTP. So what you'll do is you'll set up the FTP publishing, you'll publish your website, and then typically you can go into the control panel for your hosting service, usually a web-based interface, and you can go in there and they usually have a way that you can go in and then password protect a directory. So once again, it's not as seamless and as integrated as it is with iWeb, but you can accomplish it. And the only thing you need to know about that is if you go back and you need to make some changes and you republish your iWeb website, you may have to go in and reestablish that password protected folder. But I think in most cases, you probably won't. But just be aware of that, something to play around with. Another feature that's built into iWeb and the iWeb hosting was a hit counter. So that, you know, when someone visited your web page, you get that little counter down there at the bottom. Those are kind of old school, but a lot of people still really like them. The reality is you can find free code online that you could easily copy and paste, just a little bit of JavaScript code that you could add to your iWeb site to get a hit counter. And all you have to do in iWeb is just use the HTML snippet widget and just take the code, plug it in there, drop it on your iWeb website, and you should be good to go when you're publishing through FTP. So you can get hit counters back. The last feature, and this is kind of a big one for a lot of people, especially if you've been publishing a blog through iWeb, is comments. comments will not work, or at least the out-of-the-box ones that you get in iWeb will not work when you're publishing via FTP. But then again, you have a solution. You could go use a web-based service like Discuss, sign up for a free Discuss account, and you can add Discuss comments to your iWeb website fairly easily, again, using the HTML snippet widget and just simply copying the code that Discuss gives you and putting it into your iWeb website. So you definitely have some alternatives and choices. And as far as hosting companies, there's a million of them out there. It usually costs $4 or $5 a month, depending upon the size of your site and how much traffic you have. You're going to have to make those decisions on your own. If you're looking for a company, I don't make a lot of recommendations. I'll tell you that my website is hosted with DreamHost. I'm very happy with them. I know there's a lot of other services out there. Just talk to your friends and family, find out who they like, and you should be able to find a website host no problem. And it might end up even being cheaper for you in the long run than what you were paying with iWeb and MobileMe. If you decide you want to give up on iWeb entirely, you know, obviously you can keep your whole website in iWeb and continue to publish as long as Apple continues to support the software. How long they're going to continue to do that for, who knows? It seems like they've dropped it from the iLife plan, but the current version should work for several years into the future. But if you're ready to say, you know, I'm just going to cut bait, I'm going to move on to something else now, now's the time. There's basically two routes I think you can go. You can decide to get a new piece of software for your Mac, and you can do the hosting thing and FTP publishing, or you can use a pure web-based service. So not even have software on your Mac, just use a web-based service to handle the hosting and design and publishing of your website. So if you want to go the alternative software route and get a different application for your Mac, you might want to take a look at something like RapidWeaver from Real Mac Software, maybe Sandvox from Corellia. Freeway Express is another great option. If you don't want to deal with code at all, Freeway has a really nice bit of software in Freeway Express. And if you want to go completely the other route and get more heavily into coding and learning about HTML and JavaScript and stuff like that, Panic just came out with the new version of Coda, Coda 2, which is a great editor, has some great built-in tools and things to help you along the way. So you can check out any one of those, and those are all great. You can publish directly from FTP to your own hosting service. If you'd rather go a more simple route, something that's going to feel a little bit more like iWeb in terms of getting your site up and running quickly, being able to manage it quickly and easily, you might want to go with some sort of hosted service. So you can look at WordPress.com for free. They have templates. You basically go in, you pick the template you want. You can install add-ons and additional features, kind of move things around. The one thing their free account won't give you is a custom domain. If you need that, they have hosting and services starting at about $13 a month that you can get more storage and stuff like that. So you can check that out at WordPress.com. And the one other quick thing I'll point out about that is WordPress.com is a hosted version of WordPress, a hosted service where they give you a control panel, you log in through a web interface, and you manage the whole thing from there. WordPress also has an open source bit of software that you can install on your own server. That's something completely different. We're not going to get into that. We're just talking about the hosted services now. And that's often a point of confusion for a lot of people. So there's WordPress.com and WordPress.org, two kind of separate things with the same roots. The other way to go is to use a hosted service like Squarespace. And Squarespace is a fabulous service. It is really easy to use. A lot of people really love it. It's very powerful, very easy to manage your website, to control sidebars and menus and things like that, all from a pure web-based interface. You pick your template, you load your content, and you go. It's fairly straightforward and fairly easy. With the hosted services, if you want to migrate your previous iWeb content, there are ways to do it. You can do some Googling online to find how-tos. It can be a little bit tricky depending upon, you know, what your iWeb content looks like now, but if you have a blog or something like that, it is doable. So you can do it. And if you want to move away from iWeb, there are some options. But as I was saying earlier, you don't have to leave iWeb. You can just simply switch from iWeb publishing over to FTP publishing, get a new hosting provider, and you'll be pretty much taken care of. And you can continue to work on your website the same way that you always had, with majority of the features still intact and just working around a few others here and there. So I hope that helps you. If you want more information on all of this, again, you can check out that membership episode. Become a MacCast member over at member.maccast.com. I think I've said it before on the MacCast, but, you know, it's amazing how timing is everything. I think they maybe call this serendipity, if that's the right term. last week or about a week ago, I received an email from a client and it had a bunch of image attachments in it. And it was to one of my IMAP accounts. And I use Apple's mail application as my my app for getting mail. And instead of actually coming through as attachments, for some reason, they showed up all kind of garbled, actually as these long blocks of base 64 encoded text that showed up in line after the email message that they sent me. So there was no attachment there at all. They had this weird header that said, you know, Apple Mail content transfer encoding base 64, had the file name in there and a bunch of other stuff. And then all this long garbledy gook, which was the base 64 encoded file. So the attachment data was there, but it was just all a big giant string of text. And I ended up just having the client resend me the attachments and everything worked out fine. And I didn't have time at that specific moment to kind of research and look into why or try and figure out, you know, how to fix the whole darn thing. But of course, as I'm prepping the show, I see a posting over on the Mac Observer in their Mac Geek Gab Answers section that addressed my exact issue. Somebody else was having exactly the same problem and it asked them about it. So Jim Tanis over there had written up a response explaining what was going on and how to fix it. And it turns out this issue's been around in Mail since the days of Tiger, and specifically, I guess, affects IMAP accounts in Mail, where occasionally you'll get this problem where these attachments come across just all garbled. Luckily, it seems like it's pretty easy to actually fix. All you have to do is rebuild the IMAP mailbox. And to do that, first I would say make sure you have a backup of your mail. So if you're running Time Machine or SuperDuper or something like that, you should be fine. But make sure you have a backup just in case something goes south. Now, it really shouldn't. I think this is a relatively benign or safe procedure, but always good to have a backup. Once you've got that backup, then all you have to do is go into Mail and in the sidebar, select the mailbox that has these sort of corrupted or messed up attachments, and then go under the mailbox menu and choose rebuild. And if your mailbox has a lot of email in it, this can take some time, so you might have to sit back and wait. If you want to kind of watch the progress, you can go under the window menu and bring up the activity window to kind of see what's going on. And in my case, I had like 800, 900 emails, so it took a couple minutes for it to rebuild everything. But once I did it, lo and behold, all of those attachments were fixed. They were fine. I could access them and everything looked normal. It was completely back to normal. If you have a mailbox that has a ton of messages in it and you only have a few that have this problem, something you could do is just create a temporary IMAP folder or a temporary IMAP mailbox under that account. So do that, move the messages that are affected into it and just rebuild that. If you'd like to do that, all you have to do is go under the mailbox menu in Mail and choose new mailbox, and then create a new mailbox under the account that's having the issue. And then you can select the messages with the corrupt attachments in them and then use the message move to or the message copy to options from the menu to move those messages into that temporary mailbox. And then once they're in there, select that temporary mailbox and do the mailbox rebuild procedure that I mentioned earlier, and that should fix up just those emails, and then you can move them back once the attachments are all resolved. If for some reason you actually moved the messages from the IMAP server, so you took them off IMAP, so this fix, I guess, only works if you leave your messages up on the IMAP server, but if you actually copied them to a local folder or pulled them off of IMAP and put them, say, in the On My Mac local folders under Mail, the rebuild trick, I guess, won't work for you. In that case, you're going to have to kind of manually rebuild them. I won't go into all of the nitty-gritty details, but in essence, what you can do is you can take that long block, that base 64 encoded text string, copy it out and put it into a text file. You'll have to remove the little header information. You just want that big, long, garbly gook string. You take that out, put it into a text file, and then save that file someplace where you'll be able to locate it easily, maybe in a temporary folder on your desktop, something like that. And then you can launch the terminal and run a terminal command. You use the open SSL command and then in essence, tell it to decode the base 64 encoding and then save that back out to a file. I'll have the actual command in the show notes at maccast.com if you need it. But you run that command, and then it will generate and fix a, you know, basically create a repaired file for you, or a file that you can actually open up as the original attachment. So you probably want to give it its original extension. So in my case, like, I had JPEG files, so I was able to take that block of text in a text file and then output it to a JPEG file using the OpenSSL base 64 command. And everything worked out fine. It restored those right back to the original attachments. Kind of a long workaround. It's probably just easier to tell the person to resend them like I did. But you actually can do it. And I thought that was pretty cool. And the timing was just great. So it always kind of works out that way. You know, serendipity. And then finally, as I was saying earlier, I'm getting a lot of questions about the .Mac and the iCloud transition. If you remember on the last show, I discussed the fact that even after the iCloud transition, users on Macs that can't move over to iCloud, because iCloud's supported in macOS 10 Lion and later, but if you're on Snow Leopard or an earlier version of the operating system and you can't transition over to iCloud, you can still migrate your email and keep your .me email address. And I explained how to do that on the last episode of the MacCast. So if you missed that, you should check it out. But somewhat related to that, I got this question from Tobin.
Hey, Adam, this is Tobin from Virginia. And I'm responding to an item from your recent podcast that talks about transferring email, your email service, away from MobileMe. I've been a devoted MobileMe user for years. I'd really like to avoid Gmail if I can. I don't like the idea of Google profiling me based on my email content and users and all that. And I like the Mac.com address. I like it when I get email from other Mac.com users. And it just says a little bit, it's a little more personal. The one thing that is absolutely driving me crazy, though, is me.com. And it's the domain address. It's interchangeable with Mac.com. Works fine. I just hate the fact that from my iPhone, I can only send mail using the me.com address. I can use Mac.com on my laptop. I can use Mac.com on my iPad. But this me.com is driving me crazy. And I haven't figured out a way to change it so that my that all my messages sent from my iPhone use the Mac.com address. If I can't change that, it's driving me crazy enough that I may end up changing over to another service like Gmail. So anyway, was looking to see if you or the or your listeners had some way to change this and just eradicate this me.com from my existence. Thanks a lot, Adam. Love the show. Keep it up.
Hey, Tobin, I think I can actually help you out with that. I think in my case, I have a .Mac, and I use my @Mac email address interchangeably with my @Me address. And I think it really just has to do with whatever email you put in when you set up email on your iOS device. So if you happen to set up your account by logging into your @me.com address, then it'll pick that up and use that as the email for the email client in iOS. If you just log in and set up the account with the @mac.com address, and then all your emails should be able to use that address. They are interchangeable for a lot of people, and I'm going to get to what I mean by that here in a second. But as I was doing the research looking into the issue you were having, I did find an article that said in iOS 4.2, the operating system did force you, even if you put in your @Mac address when you set up the email, it would force you back to an @me.com address. But I guess that was fixed in iOS version 4.3. So under iOS 5 and later, you should be totally fine on this. And I actually have mine set up exactly like that. I logged in with my @Mac address. And so when I send email from that account, it shows up as being from @Mac. So you should have no problem doing that and setting it up. Now, what I have to tell everybody else is that this only works if you originally had an @Mac email address. So if you didn't sign up with MobileMe or iCloud until they were those services, you probably only have an @me.com address, and you cannot just simply interchange that with @Mac. You would have had to have been a .Mac subscriber and originally gotten a .Mac address. in order for this to work. The two aren't interchangeable, and I just found out that recently as well, because we had a listener who had an at me, an at mac.com address, and then got rid of it, got an at me address, and then wanted to get the at Mac address back, and found out the two were completely separated. Even though they had kind of both accounts, because one had been canceled, they couldn't reactivate it. They had a new account using the same front portion, the same, you know, username, but they were relegated to just having the at me address. So they aren't interchangeable unless you've originally had your at Mac address, and then you can continue to use it. So just something to be aware of there. Another question somewhat related to this that I also received this week was somebody was asking me about MobileMe aliases, email aliases, and would those make the transition over to iCloud? Would you be able to keep your at me.com email aliases? And I wasn't really sure on this. I thought I had originally heard that that feature was not going to be supported in the transition to iCloud, but it turns out it actually is. So what an email alias is, in case you don't know about this is an additional email address that you can get. You can set up and create it through the web interface at iCloud.com, and it will allow you to get additional at me email addresses that will just go to the inbox of your main account. So these can be particularly useful maybe if you want to have a different email address that you give out to people that's separate from your actual at me.com email address. And the one use case I could think about this is a lot of us use our at me.com email address as our Apple ID. So maybe you don't want to give everybody your Apple ID. You want to give them some other email address. You can go in and you can create an alias and get in a different kind of a different account name or a different email address. And so that can be really useful. If you had these set up prior to the iCloud migration, because you could set these up under MobileMe, they will continue to work. You get to keep them. They will transition over just fine. If you want to set them up now under iCloud, if you've never had them before, iCloud does have a new limit. I forget how many you could have under MobileMe, but under iCloud, you are allowed to create up to 3 email aliases. And the way you do that is you log into iCloud.com, you go into the mail section, so into the mail app at iCloud.com, you click on the settings, which is the little cog in the upper right-hand corner, you click on that, and then you're going to click into the accounts area. And then you'll notice in the column on the left down there at the bottom, there is a click to add an alias option. And it'll tell you how many of 3 you have set up. So it'll say you can set up to 3 and you have 1 of 3 or 2 of 3, however many you have set up. And if you are transitioning from MobileMe and you have more than 3 email aliases already set up, you do get to keep them. They'll all transition. The one thing is you won't be able to create any new ones, and you can delete them, but you can't get more than 3 back. So if you have 5 and you delete one, you're down to 4. You can't add a 5th one back in. You're now stuck at 4. When you drop down to 3, you'll be stuck at 3. If you go back down to 2, then you can add a new one. So you'd have to delete one before you could add another one. So you, once you're on iCloud, you can only have a maximum of 3 email addresses unless you were grandfathered in from an old MobileMe account. So that's what I found out about email aliases. Probably more confusing than I was hoping that would be, but hopefully that all made sense. And with that, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the MacCast. Thanks for hanging out with me. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Pharonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software. Get more information and details at pharonix.com. Circus Ponies, check out Notebook. You can get a free trial and more information and details over at circusponies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPad, and Text Expander Touch. You can get more information on all their software as well as free Mac trials over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, you can get cash for your old smartphone, specifically your iPhone, your iPad, also Mac products, by doing a simple search over at gazelle.com. They'll give you a cash offer. It's quick and easy and simple. Check it out over at gazelle.com. And VMware. If you need to run Windows on your Mac, and some of us do, it might as well be easy and seamless, and VMware Fusion for Mac makes that possible. You can check it out as well as get 10% off VMware by using the code MACCAST by going to vmware.com/Mac. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. If you have a question, topic, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, I would love to hear from you. You can send email to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the maccast.com website. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum. I recently upgraded the forum. Great community of MacCast listeners hanging out, answering questions, helping each other out. If you haven't checked it out before, check it out at forum.maccast.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast.com Facebook page. That's over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.